Hey, hey, you're listening to the Produce Like a Boss podcast, where we are arming you with the tools that you need to become a six-figure producer. And I am obviously not the wonderfully talented Chris Bradley. My name is Patrick Clark. I am the brand manager over here at Produce Like a Boss. And if you've been listening to the podcast for the last several weeks, then you might my voice might be familiar to you. I have taken on the role of co-host of this podcast with Chris, and we've just been having an absolute blast bringing you a brand new format for the show. And I'm jumping in here for a special introduction because we have a special episode, and we are joined this week by the incredibly talented Tyler Summers. And Tyler is just an absolute powerhouse in the world of sync and licensing, especially when it comes to ad placements. Everything from Subway, McDonald's, Toyota, Starbucks, you name it, this guy has probably got a song placed with them. And we just had an incredible conversation about sort of everything that independent artists like you need to know about getting your music placed in the world of advertising. So without further ado, let's just jump right in. All right, and welcome back, everyone, to a brand new episode of the Produce Like a Boss podcast. So happy to be joining you. I know we were away for a week or two because we were launching some exciting things, as I'm sure you already know about, but we're back in action this week. I'm, of course, joined by the wonderful and talented Chris Bradley. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing wonderful, thank you.
So happy to be back in action. And we have a special guest joining us on the show today, Mr. Tyler Summers. How are you doing, my friend?
I am doing fabulous, and I'm so grateful to be with you guys.
It's great to connect. Fellow Canadian here on the podcast. We're just trying to take over Produce Like a Boss. That's what we were talking about off air. Michael and I, the Canadians on the team, are bringing in Tyler now. It's just it's going to be a Canadian takeover.
It's a very quiet takeover, which is exactly what Canadians do.
Very Canadian. Subtly infiltrate. Be very polite about it.
It's a very quiet, polite takeover. Yes. I'm not mad at it.
I love it. And so today we are talking about one of the hottest topics in the music industry right now, sync and licensing, and particularly how it relates to the world of advertising, which is Tyler's forte, you know, wheel of expertise. And I'm just so excited to get a chance to hear, you know, your perspective as an avatar. We were talking about, I'm a student of Produce Like a Boss as much as I am a team member. And I spent a lot of time in that sync and licensing world, and, you know, reading a bit about your story and stuff, it sounds like you came up against a lot of walls yourself. And I was certainly very much like, you know, you have that conversation with your mom, like, hey, we almost got on Grey's Anatomy. And they'd be like, you're on Grey's Anatomy? Like, no, we almost got on Grey's Anatomy. And that's like, that's pretty good. Like, people don't almost get on Grey's Anatomy. So I'm so excited to hear your story and your journey. And so, Chris, I'm going to throw it over to you as we kind of dive in and unpack. We've got some questions here, and let's just dig into this thing.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Tyler, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today and chat all about this. Patrick is absolutely right. It's such a hot topic, you know, like who doesn't want to get their music into film and TV, and especially like ad spots. It's kind of like this coveted thing because we all know that the payouts can be really big and the recognition can be amazing, and so can the clients. So let's just jump right in at the top. Like, how did you break into producing for ads?
Well, it took a long time, but as it always does. But yeah, it's an interesting world. I came to it because I remember having a conversation with my my then girlfriend at the time. We were broke and I could barely afford pizza for my band. And I was pursuing the artist thing. And I kind of looked at the world, which is kind of something that I've kind of done throughout my career. And I looked at the long game and I was kind of like, well, what is going to always be there? And I realized that brands are always going to want music, and Coca-Cola is not going to run out of money. And I thought to myself, how can I figure out a way to get into that world? Little did I know that it would take about 8 years to actually get into the world. But yeah, it was absolutely 100% chasing those big sinks. And a lot of people don't know that there's also a lot of little micro syncs that go along with it too. So I started with it by getting into the sync world and then doing actual syncs, not advertising syncs, but syncs. And then all of a sudden I started getting what the ad people call briefs. And I'm seeing numbers like $80,000, $100,000. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, I'm playing a $300 wedding gig. What? I could be making $100,000. And it's so funny. It's like I started seeing that, and it was so fascinating as a human being going through that and learning how to get into that world, because it is so interesting about how it's so much different than being an artist. It's like you can't take things personal. And it's like, you just have to show up and keep showing up and keep pitching and making people feel like making people's job easy, showing up professionally. And that was one of the things that I just felt like was a real through thread from that, was just realizing that
It's a business.
Like, it's a business. And these people just need music. They need it quickly. And you have to be ready to get it to them. And you can't take things personally. And man, did I take things personally for a very long time. So I kept saying, like, I just kept getting these, kept getting no. And for about 8 years, I sat there and I just looked at what it was. You know, why are they saying no? What are the things that I'm doing that they like? What are the things that, like, sometimes it would be silence. And then I'd finally get an email and they would say, thank you. And then I realized, oh, thank you actually means that this is something that they're actually going to pitch. It's not like that was of their version of thank you, this is a cool track. They're not going to go to that length. They're just going to pitch it, go, you know? So getting into it was me moving myself from an artist career of producing singer-songwriters, where I was realizing that streaming was coming, CD sales were down, people were taking touring revenues. And I was looking at all this landscape and I was like, man, I just don't want that life. I don't want to pursue that life. Like, I would love to feel stable, like have a family, have a house, build a studio. And I shifted from producing artists to, how can I get into this game and how can I learn the tricks and the rules? And I just dove in, and every time I got a no or every time I got a positive response, I would just put it in the checklist and be like, okay, that's something to remember for next time. And okay, I'm not going to do that again. And I just learned a lot of tricks and a lot of valuable lessons that eventually got me to a place where the floodgates opened and it was just commercial after commercial after commercial. And then it just hit. And I was like, oh, okay. Now I know. Now I know the rules. I'm not taking it personal if they say no. And then it was just off to the races.
Yeah. I love that pivot of mindset from, you know, like, hey, this is what I'm doing as an artist, to like, hey, this is what I'm going to do as a business. Mm-hmm. And there's some new skill sets that I need to bring to this, including having a very thick skin, being very coachable, learnable, like, okay, learn that, going to do this, not going to do that again. Ooh, that worked good this time. Oh, that person ghosted me. That was a no, you know, and being able to collect all that and not just be the sensitive, wonderful, you know, heart-centered artist that we are, which it takes to sometimes create the art, but to be able to say, okay, I'm not wearing that hat right now, is a really powerful mindset shift. And I just wanted to also kind of address something really cool, which is that flip of the switch from, okay, B2C is not looking so good right now, right? Which means business to consumer, okay? We got streaming coming in. We've got, you know, CDs aren't really pushing as fast. And then being able to go, you know, I've got this talent, I've got this skill. And there's a saying in business and marketing, right message, wrong audience, right? Mm. And you said, but it's not being valued in the way that I would like it to be valued. And I know that if I just take this same talent and skill over here, stack a few more skills on it to become like business-minded and present it to this audience, right? Brands never run out of money. Brands aren't sitting there going like, hey, I'm going to give you a quarter of a cent for streaming this, right? So like, what do you think was like, how did you flip that switch? Because not every artist has that ability to go from sensitive, heart-centered, like, I'm an artist, I do what I love, and, you know, and be able to turn on the business switch. What was it for you that allowed you to adapt that?
One of the things that I definitely find interesting, as I know you do, Chris, too, is not only the music side of things, but the marketing side of things. And I'm very grateful that that's something that interests me, because most artists just like, that's like so overwhelming to them. So what I did was I took that future looking concept of, I know that they're never going to run out of money. And I know that I have these skills. And not only that is, I know a lot of fabulous, fabulous artists. And I'm a connector, which I know you are too. And I love connecting people. And not only that, and I'm getting chills because I remember we had a conversation, you and I, where you were talking about Produce Like a Boss, and you were like, oh, I'm getting chills. Where you're like, I live for the emails that come to me that say that like I've changed their life, or I've like unlocked a secret. It's like, I looked at these artists and I said, you are struggling like we all are. And you have an amazing talent. You can write amazing songs. You can sing your butt off. Most of them, honestly, were singers. And I would then say, I would pitch to them. I say, listen, I know that you're playing the $75 bar gig, but I think you have an amazing talent. And I think that you can make some money in this industry. And I have the connections. Don't worry about it. Come over for a day. We'll write a song. I'll get your vocals down and then I'll finish it out. I'll produce it. And then we'll do 50-50, 50-50 split, and I'll get it out there. And I have made some of my dear friends thousands and thousands, and a couple of them hundreds of thousands of dollars to put into their career just by coming over and hanging out. So I realized that instead of us start writing a heartfelt song for their record, which is going to get streamed for 3 cents, mm-hmm. I said, well, why don't we use these rules that I've figured out, or I'm actually like figuring out and trying things. So what would happen was, yes, I do believe there has to be a heart in it. And the artist would bring the heart, and I would take that heart, and then I would kind of mold it and say, just trust me, just trust me. And that's how I ended up kind of moving into the space of, it was just, the heart needs to be there for sure, but you can get the heart.
Right.
But if you mix it with that business mindset and realize, hey, I know you want to talk about your ex-boyfriend that's just cheated on you, but I'm like, you're never going to get an ad with that. So why don't we just take that same melody and talk about how much, you know, friendship means to you, you know?
Right.
Let's keep it platonic, people, you know? Yeah. So it was one of those things where the heart, I have the heart in music too, and I do believe the ones that were most successful were the ones that were early on. In fact, it's not a matter of believing, it's true. Because mm-hmm. I do believe that you have to have a piece of heart in there, even if the subconscious listener doesn't realize that, because most mm-hmm. of the time they're just an ad agency sitting around making $400,000 a day in a year in a conference room hitting play. So I realized that you do have to have the heart. And some of our early ones where we had the most fun, those are the ones that to this day, 10 years later, are still syncing because people can hear that heart. But it's that purity of the artist that I was able to bring in and help, which is the whole reason that I was doing it, really. And then we could combine the marketing and I could combine the connections and I could just put them in the advertising box just for a second.
Right.
And that seemed to be the recipe that really worked.
So it was a combination, right? It's mm-hmm. not like, oh, and I think artists feel that way so often too. Like, I'm either like heart-centered or I'm greedy. I'm either doing it for the man or I'm sticking it to the man. Like, it's like, no, it's the perfect combination. I like to say it like this. I always think of like, you know, there's either a flood, right, which is chaotic, or you have a beautiful river flowing down a bank. But in order for it to do so, you have to have the riverbanks, right? So sometimes those little boundaries that people like you and I, Tyler, can find and go, okay, cool, let's fit it into this so that it can flow into a direction that can actually feed your artist career more than just doing anything you want, which is kind of the flood, right?
Absolutely. I love that. It's a beautiful analogy. Totally.
Patrick, I saw Patrick.
When we were, you know, when I was writing a lot of stuff, especially early in the pandemic, that became sort of a channel that people started pursuing in sync writing. And it took a minute to get your, you know, mind adjusted around like frameworks for sync licensing. Cause I think particularly then once you start looking for hooks that will work in sync, we were able to sort of channel that same creativity, you know, as we would for a song that maybe was really personal, but it did take a lot of time. And as you started, like, more and more people started kind of writing in that world, you had to kind of be like, hey guys, like, here's the walls we're playing within. Like, if we go this way, that's cool, but this song is going to die on the vine because we can't use it or pitch it. And people on our crew were getting publishing deals and stuff that work sort of these avenues for pitching these sync songs. But it took, you know, it wasn't an easy transition if you're so used to writing artist career and I'm in country. So we were really like super specific lyrics, right? And I'm sure you guys know from Nashville time too, like the Nashville sort of writing stuff, that specificity can hurt you sometimes depending on, you know, the world you're working in sync. So it's a big pivot you have to make. So that's so interesting to sort of hear how you got to collaborate with artists to sort of bring the best of both worlds into it.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is such an interesting, lyrically especially, it's such an interesting world because you're right. The more specific you are, I come from a concept of, my writing concept was, unless I'm writing directly for an ad agency that wants a specific thing, it's like, how do I do a blanket song that I just know is going to work? Mm. And that's been the most success. So you're right. It's like, if you're talking about having a six pack, driving down, you know, by the lake with your friends, it's like, yeah, that's cool. But like, you're writing to a picture, you know, and if that picture is not saying that, it's like, you're like, odds of that song. Yeah. And I'm not saying there are so many odd things that happen in the ad world. Like Apple is an example. Like, they've broken so many artists by specific things that they build the commercial around. And that's just not the way it works. Most of the time, if you want to win, I'd say 85 to 90% of the time, the song already exists. and it's in your hard drive, and they're like, I need this by 3 p.m. and right. you have to deliver it, you know, and it has to be something that they can cut and chop up and do whatever. Most of the time, they don't even use the lyrics. So it's like, you just have to have it ready. And to me, mm-hmm. the best way to go about it and that I felt I had the most success with was, you're right, not be specific. Take these artists and pull them out of that. And like, let's not talk about, you know, what you had for breakfast this morning. It's like, because, right. you know, if you're only going to get a Maxwell House coffee ad with that. You know, it's like, you're right. not, just don't talk about that. It's like mm-hmm. metaphorically, there's rules and you still have to be deep, but you can't be too deep. Like it's, mm-hmm. it really is a fascinating world that when you really dive into it, it's just so much about the subconscious and the listener and what they're experiencing on the other end.
Totally. You know what? It's so funny. This is like bringing flashbacks back to like my whole songwriting career. And I think of like all the phases that I went through. It was like, you know, the suck factor of not really good to like, ooh, craft, I'm getting crafty. Ooh, okay. And then like all the ego that's involved with like wanting to, you know, express something in a clever way, right? Like, for example, like that's those specifics in Nashville are so when they're really good, you get yeah. that like, oh, in the writer's room from the other writers. And then everybody's just like having a songwriter love fest. But, you know, in the end of the day, sometimes like simplicity and not being clever, but just saying something the way that it is and being universal, that often is the thing that will win something like this, right? And I just found, you know, as I started to write more towards assignments and briefs, and I was feeling like I was in a cage a little bit. At first it started with, okay, I'll do this because this will make money. But then it became like, no, I get why this works. I'm not excluding anyone. It's not too clever for anyone. This speaks to everyone. This melody is so catchy that like no matter what language you speak, you're going to love it. Like these universal themes, I eventually fell in love with writing music like that, where I went from this kind of purist artist trying to be something cool and clever and, you know, kind of serving myself to, there's a reason this stuff works. And it's not just because some guy in a suit is trying to put you in a box, right? If we want to get into business, like there's data, there's evidence, there is like a market. And they're looking at it going, we've got to use this to sell a product. How can we communicate in a way that like everyone gets this? And this is where we have to kind of take off that ego hat that I think that we have as an artist that wants to, and I don't mean to say ego in a negative way, we want to be praised for our talents, right? And so sometimes we don't realize like that simplicity is the best way and we're kind of wanting to overdo it, you know? And for me, just getting out of that all of a sudden, like I woke up and I was excited to write music that also happened to be profitable. Did that happen for you as well, Tyler, where you went from like, okay, I'm doing this for, and then you're like, no, this is awesome. Like I used to hate pop music and then I fell in love with writing pop music because of the simplicity.
Absolutely love that. It is so true. I mean, the ego obviously in every situation when it comes to art is an interesting thing to navigate. And I definitely had that. And as you're saying that, I'm kind of going back and thinking about it. It's interesting that because you did say, well, the ego has to be there in a certain way. And you're absolutely right. And I'm yeah. thinking about my time. It's like, and I'm not slamming any of the people that I worked with, but I was always really good at managing egos. And, yeah. and it's so funny. It's like the people that everybody hate are always the ones that are my friends. I don't know why, but it's like, I just make them safe, you know? And it's like, because I'm not combating them. I'm just trying to help. And you know, as singers have to have an ego. Like there's mm-hmm. a reason why Celine Dion slays, you know, like yeah. you may not want to have lunch with her, but she's a freaking great singer. So it's like, it's not to say, who knows? I mean, I've never had lunch with her, but maybe she's great. I don't know. But yeah, it's like I was always really good at managing that artist ego and allowing that to flourish in the studio setting so that I could put it in a box. And I think that's the thing that you hit on totally. It's, I think we feel safer as human beings when we have rules. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that, you know, like I used to be a jazz musician and I say that because I was a lot better than I am now if I'm playing saxophone these days. But it's like, I remember somebody saying like, can you just improvise, just play? And the person was like, well, what's the rules? Like, what song am I playing? What am I improvising on? And I thought to myself, I was like, interesting. Even in the jazz world where you're improvising, you still need some kind of structure. And mm-hmm. the thing that I find really interesting about advertising is it is such a fascinating example of structure. And the way that I would approach some of these songs is I literally would already have it mapped out and we would just sit in the studio and be like, okay, well, let's just fill this verse. Okay, what are we going to do in this chorus? And literally like you can have a map of a song for advertising, which is very different than pop music, as Chris, I know you know. It's like you have this map and you're basically just filling it in. It's like you're coloring. It's like a coloring book, you know? And you have your two or three hooks and you throw them around and you've got your thing. And then you go, here you go. Here's your 2 minute song. You know, it's so fun because the rules are so like, there's no questions. So when you take somebody that doesn't like rules and has a strong ego because they have an amazing career or a singer or whatever, if you make that singer feel safe and you just say, hey, listen, like, it's not that hard. Like, you'll say a line and are you sure that line is what we should use? And I'm like, yes, it's done. It's done. We're good. We're having a good life. That's the line. Good life. Okay, cool. Well, what does that mean? Where's the depth there? I'm like, no, you're good. It's just like, have a good life. We'll fill in to make it be cool, but that's the hook, you know? And it is what, to me, out of all the different things I've done in the music industry, it has the most rules. And it is one of those things where if you like to be in a box like that, you feel safe, you show up, and it is business-like. It's like, okay, let's just fill these boxes with this beautiful thing that you have, this gift that you have, and then we're going to present it and see what happens. And it really is just that simple. If you look at it from the perspective of, I'm not approaching this to try to change the world. I'm approaching this to tick the boxes and make something that sounds cool and see what happens, you know, and not attach yourself to it.
Right. And fulfill the needs of that client, you know.
Absolutely.
I know for me that when I started doing work for hire stuff, like custom work, that was the most comfortable I ever felt because it was like, oh, I had this guidance, you know, of like, here's where we need you to go. Here's what we want you to deliver. I'll tell you what, if you handed me a blank piece of paper and you told me to draw you like a bear or a tree, that just gives me anxiety just thinking about it. But if you like handed me a page with like an outline and gave me some crayons and were like, hey, could you color this in? I'd be like, I got you, you know? So
totally.
I love the way you put that. So, okay. As simple as it sounds now, I'm sure that it wasn't always this simple, right? There had to be some challenges for you, especially in the beginning. What would you say was the biggest challenge for you entering into the world of producing for ads?
I would say the biggest challenge was learning the word no meant something different than my ego thought it meant.
Ooh.
It's one of those things, you know, everybody talks about it all the time and it's, you know, till they're blue in the face, you have to fail to succeed. And it's a little bit deeper than that. When the ad world, it's kind of one of those things where you have to not attach yourself, first of all, to tracks, like we just said, because there's mm-hmm. tracks that I spent a lot of time on that have made this much money. there is one particular track that I did with a person, a singer that we did it in about 3.5 hours, and it's probably made over the course of its life, I would guess, like $120,000. So, and last quarter, I still got another sync for it. So it just perpetually syncs. So you just never know. It's like, it's not a matter of how much time you put into it. It's a matter of, I always think about, I know I'm going off topic, but I think about Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan as these two things that Malcolm Gladwell talked about, where Bob Dylan would just churn out songs, but Leonard Cohen was not finished with Hallelujah when he died. You know, it's like we all work differently. And I think when you're in a box, you can put something together and you can send it off and not attach to it. So I learned that the word no meant a lot of things. It meant that I needed to either look at the quality of what I was putting out, and there was actually people that I work with that I was like, waiting for their email after they listened to it, you know, because my ego just needed to know whether they liked it or not. And when I got a yes, I'm like, oh my God, I'm safe. But it was like, it's not about that, you know? And I realized like, they don't mean me any harm when they say this track isn't good enough. And then the one thing that I really realized that I took really hard, this quick little story at the very beginning of when I was starting to write ads, there was a K Jewelers campaign that was coming out. And I pitched a song from an artist's perspective, because here's the funny thing. It's the only time in my entire career that I ever had a chance to write a love song for an advertisement. So it was a love song. So I'm like, that's my wheelhouse. I'm a singer songwriter. So I wrote this song, and it was up against somebody else who actually worked for the publishing company that I wrote it for. And that's a whole nother conversation, because, you know, they're going to make more money off of him, obviously. But I didn't get it. And I was crushed. I was like, the world is out to get me. Like, I took it really hard. And I realized that, well, maybe I wasn't the right one for them, you know? And it's oftentimes in this industry and in any type of sync world, because I've seen it happen over and over and over again. Sometimes the best place to be is the last song they hear before the deadline. And I realized that sometimes, and also, as you know, Chris, you know, Patrick too, it's like they get this thing called demo-itis, where they'll hear something that like a basic track that just a licensing track, like a sync thing that's just random, and they get attached to it, you know, and they can't, you're trying to like chase that tail. And that is super frustrating because you can't copy it, you know, and they already have this thing. So yeah, I think the biggest takeaway is you can't take things personally. And as soon as I started realizing, it's funny how this works. As soon as I started realizing that no's were a gift, no's were information, then I could separate myself from it and step back and not be subjective about it, but be objective about it and go, let me look at this and not attach to it and go, what are they saying? No, don't take it personal. And sometimes what I would do, and this is really difficult to do, I know, because our ego and our fears, we don't want to know this answer. But sometimes if somebody says no and you have a trusting relationship with them, you can actually email them back and say, can you tell me why you didn't like my track? And that takes a lot of just separate yourself, because if you want to know, you have to ask and you have to let them be honest. Because if they're like, hey, the intro was too long, that's some freaking valuable information. They're like, your track started and I was bored. I'm like, wait a minute, what? It needs to be exciting right away? Like, that's a gift, you know? And that information, I realized when I realized the no's weren't my enemies, the no's were my friend. That's when I really started to move up the ladder to really start picking out these tools that kind of got me over the top. No is your friend.
Yeah, failure is feedback, right?
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, failure is such feedback. And if you can get more feedback by asking the even more difficult question is, why didn't I get it? They could just say, hey, it wasn't for the client, didn't really feel like it was for them. Cool, you know?
You know, what's really interesting of how you're framing that. I heard this great quote one time that was the idea of like, you know, if you knew it took 99 no's to become successful, you would like hunt down no's like it was your day job, and you would interact with them differently. And like you're saying, you know, as artists, I think it's so easy to like face rejection. And also like this craft is so like vulnerable, and it's inherently like you're putting yourself out there. So rejection like hurts even more. But, you know, to sort of be a breakthrough a threshold, we're like, all right, I need 99 no's, like, and I got to get as much information because I know the yes is coming. And I think that's so hard for artists to, you know, people breaking into this world to get their head around. They're like, hey, you're going to have to like fail a ton. And you actually need that so you can inform how to succeed what they want. And that's just, you know, it's just so difficult for anything artistic. I think acting and dancing and, you know, that artistic field is just so, we're so empathetic as people to go into this world, just get like totally rejected in the harshest way of any other, you know, sort of like field.
Well, and it's very much like a business world too. Like, I know Chris is really much into that too. We've had great talks, like Adam Horowitz, I think it was, that said, if you want to be a good salesperson, get hung up on 1,000 times. You know, it's like, if you treat this world like that, like if you want to be good in this world, just get told no, you know? But it's different because it's your music. You've been in love with it since you were a baby, you know?
Yeah. Oh my God. So much good stuff in there. I love it. So I'm curious, like, out of all the stuff that you've done so much, like, what's your favorite placement ever where it was a hell yes for you through the creation, like the compensation, just an all around win? What's your favorite placement?
It was probably the first big one. So when my mountaintop was, I really wanted to hear I wanted to hear one of my songs on television, and I really wanted to like hear my voice on television because I'm a saxophone player, you know, and I was like really insecure about my singing. So I was like, that'd be really cool, you know, to hear that. So I remember the funny thing is the company that I was working for, who I did a lot of my placements with, who I helped kind of build up their company as one of their writers. A lot of the times we would get placements and we would not know because we were writing things ahead of time that were just placement friendly. And then all of a sudden he's like, dude, I can't keep up. So I'm going to send you whatever comes, but I can't be in control of it. So I didn't even know that I got this placement. And I was sitting on my couch in Nashville, Tennessee with my cat Ping at the time, who's since passed, poor little guy. But I'm sitting on the couch with Ping and I'm about to watch Jimmy Fallon. And this was probably like, this was the big first, like this is 8 years in, and it was probably the first one in the, and one of the biggest ones I've ever had. So I'm sitting there about to watch Jimmy Fallon. It's like, you know, 10 o'clock at night or whatever. And all of a sudden, this Subway commercial comes on. And it's like the $3.50 footlong or whatever. And I'm listening to it and I'm like, what the? Wait a minute. No. Wait, what? And it was a quick like 15 seconds. And then I heard myself go, da 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 da. I'm like, that's me. And I was like, what in the heck? And you just like, it was one of those moments where you're just like, what? What's like, I didn't even know it was coming, you know? Oh, and it gosh. And it just happened. And it's so funny. I learned so much off of that sync because I called my company and I'm like, dude, you didn't tell me we got a... So it ended up being a national Subway ad for the whole like fourth quarter.
Wow.
And it ended up airing over 8,000 times.
Whoa.
And it was like... And the funny thing about it is, and you'd think that you'd be like, oh man, that was a big payday. This is what's so interesting about advertising is the front end, all I got for that was $750 after all the splits. And he's like, don't worry. Don't worry. And then I learned all these really cool things about advertising where if your song plays at a certain time of day, you get a certain amount of money. And if it plays during prime time, it's like how many people are watching it. So I learned a lot. And then I got my first royalty statement. And that was $12,000. So it was like one of those. Yeah, it was one of those things where you're like, OK, cool. I mean, sometimes it's just such an interesting world because sometimes the front end is $100,000 and they buy you out. Sometimes the back, right. You know, it's so many different rules and it just, yeah. So that had to be probably the coolest one. You never forget your first.
That's, you know, what's hilarious about that story is like, it's almost simulation-y in the sense of like, you know, as artists, you always want to hear your song on the radio, but you don't want to know it's coming. Like I've had songs play on the radio right. Like one time and then I'll go in the car and I'll hear it. It's like, yeah, you want to catch it in the wild. That's like,
I love that. I love that. Yeah.
And when that happens, like that happened to me, you know, for the first time, like I was just driving and it came on and you're like, this is what everyone said it was going to be like. It's as amazing as they thought. So for like your first huge sync to actually be like, man, I wonder if I'm ever going to get sync placements and then it's a Subway commercial. Like it's almost like too fairy tale. That's such an incredible experience for that first.
Yeah, I love that. Like to hear it in the wild. I'm going to need to borrow that one.
All yours. You take that for what you want.
Oh my gosh. I love that one. So, you know, I think just based on what I've seen in our community, you know, I've seen this kind of question floating around a lot where artists are very particular about what they want to attach their name to. And for good reason, you know, we put in a lot of work to develop our brands and have our own unique messaging that comes with that. So there's not always going to be synergy, right, between a lot of these different, you know, companies that you could potentially be partnering with by writing their song. So I'm curious, like, how does a musician break into the ad world if they don't want to attach their artist name to other brands?
You know what? It's something that I dealt with on a regular basis. And I think that's a very fair thing to bring up. I had a lot of people that built their careers that were really great artists that wanted to break into the scene, but they're like, hey man, like I don't drink. So it's like, I don't really want to be on a Budweiser commercial. And that's very fair. And I totally get that. And I think the solution, oftentimes the difficult things lead to a solution that actually makes it even better. And what can happen with that and what I actually experienced was what you're able to do is you're able to step back and look at what your strengths are and you pick out what those things are. And then what you do with those strengths is you say, well, how can I build a brand around that strength? So my particular thing was I was good at singer-songwriter. I was play saxophones and horns. So I had like an R&B throwback thing going on that I could do. I can play piano. So I could do like a classical kind of piano thing. And then the other thing I did a lot was like orchestral kind of popish stuff. So what I did was I built four brands that I could pitch. It's just me. And the way that I would do that was I would come up with a concept of what the sound was going to be. I would come up with the name of a band. I would start, I would come up with the color scheme. I'd come up with the logo. I'd start building the social media around it. And what I would do and what my advice to anybody that wants to do this is say you're an artist and you have, you know, 1,000, 2,000 fans. And it's like, you don't want to pitch this stuff to them because it's not, if you're really doing it by the rules that I believe you need to do it by, you might land something as an artist. That's, again, there's no hard and fast rules about that. But if you really want to land in this business, almost, I could pretty much guarantee that your fans are not going to want to listen to what you're going to put out, because it's not going to be a thing that is going to be like re-listenable from the soul. As far as like, the interesting thing about ab music is you can't make it too interesting, but you have to make it interesting, because you can't take away from the picture, and but it still has to get, they still have to love it on the first listen. And oftentimes when you listen to an ab piece away from the picture, it's just like, oh, I would never really listen to this because it's kind of boring. So what you would do is you would take your superpower. And this is what I did, is I would take those four superpowers that I felt that I had, and I would either collaborate with like a great R&B singer, or I would collaborate with the singer-songwriters. And here's the genius is you make a band name, and it doesn't need to be, it could just be you, that's fine. But what I did was I would take a band name under a singer-songwriter umbrella, and I'd have like five different singer-songwriters that would be under this umbrella. So I'd build a band and I'd get like a following, or I'd reach out to people and I'd have the social media, but I could put it under an umbrella of a singer-songwriter sound with guest artists. So I was the producer, and then I would have collaborations with people outside of myself and put it under this umbrella. So basically what you're doing is you're building an umbrella of a brand that you can then take the sound and put it inside of. So I have a orchestral kind of classical thing that I have called Imaginary Owl. So anything that I do with Imaginary Owl is an instrumental thing, an instrumental pop thing. But also, like, I'll have friends come over and we'll do like a Black Keys-y kind of sound, but mixed with my sound to make it Imaginary Owl, but they're now in on it. So what you're doing is you're combining superpowers and putting it under an umbrella. So my advice to an artist would be, really take some time, look in the mirror and go, what am I the best at? What am I better than anything that I can do? What is resonating the most with people in my artist career? And the first thing I would do is build an umbrella around that. And the second thing I would do is find other people that are really good at things that you're not really good at. So you can be an amazing singer, but you don't have any clue how to build tracks or beats. Go find somebody that's really freaking good at building beats. And then what you're going to do is the more superpowers that combine, it's like Captain Planet, Earth, Wind, whatever, you know, the more you can have, like, it's just basically you're exponentially growing your ability to land these things because you're combining superpowers. So it's literally just building an umbrella that can encompass a sound. And it's really deciding the sound, coming up with the name, building the vibe, build a website. My favorite trick that I learned early on, I'm like, man, I see all these like bands, but they're not even really bands. Like I watched this guy just slay it with like, he had a Black Keys band, singer-songwriter band. He's actually the guy that ended up getting that K-Jewelers commercial I was talking about. But like, and he had like an electronic band and it was all under this umbrella. And he'd have these websites that would look super cool and all these things. But like, man, like, how do they believe that he's a band? And he did this trick where you'd go to his website and he'd hit tour dates because you're like, this guy's not even touring. And it would always say, currently in the studio making a new record. I'm like, genius! Like, so an ad agency is going to go there and go like, that's what they want to do. And I think that's the important thing is you have to make it current. You have to make it cool. Think about the guy that's sitting in the office that, you know, that wears a suit and tie. He wants to be attached to cool. He wants to be attached to an energy. So you have to create that energy, and you can create that energy under an umbrella. You don't even need to use your face. That happens all the time. It's just a vibe, a look. You know, go to Adobe Express or Canva and create a vibe. You know, there's so many opportunities to do that there. And what they want to do is all they want to do is love your track, go to your website and see that you're doing things. And then all of a sudden they're attaching to your vibe. And that's the other thing too, is on the flip side, if you really want to do this as an artist, the thing that is really fascinating is in briefs, always, 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 and I know you guys know this, it says the budget is flexible depending on the artist. Mm-hmm. And that means that, like, I had a really fascinating thing happen where I was working with a guy up in New York and he called me and he said, hey, I got this Glade commercial. They wanted Rihanna, but she wanted $500,000. And all that Rihanna need to do was, and I'm feeling good, you know, that Nina Simone thing.
Right.
And that's all he needed. And they were like, she wants $500,000. And he was and here's another thing is he was in a rush. He needed it right away. And he's like, Tyler, I need help. And sure enough, I had a singer that could knock it out, and she came in and did it and ended up doing 3 Glade commercials back to back to back and made over $100,000. And it's like, that's the thing, is you realize that whatever it is that you're doing, like, you could sound like the Rolling Stones. And when Rolling Stones say, I want $1.5 million for Satisfaction, and you go, well, hang on a second, I got a song that sounds like Satisfaction. I'll give it to you for 50 grand. It's like, you just have to look at what's working and what the sound is and what's current. And I know I went on a little bit of a tangent there, but I think this is a really valuable piece of information. As you're building your sound, as you're building your brand and your umbrella, pop music is typically about 12 to 16 months ahead of advertising music. So, and the way that I know that is because it's worked for me over and over and over. My most successful song that I've ever had that's made over $100,000 and it's still sinking was a copy of Meghan Trainor. It was like, it's exactly Meghan Trainor. My singer sounds like Meghan Trainor. The track sounds like Meghan Trainor. It's throwback soul. And Meghan hit with that big track. And I'm blanking on the name of it now.
All About That Bass.
We're like, let's make an All About That Bass. And we did. And sure enough, 8-10 months later, it was just like, bam, bam, bam. And that song, actually, my guy that pitches it said, if there was a billboard for number one, like, song of the year for advertising, he said this would be in the running because it just was so popular. And it was just literally us chasing pop music 12 months ahead.
Right.
Wow. That's really good insight to have, right? Like, as you're watching the charts, know that it is about 10 to 12 months ahead. So all you have to do is reverse engineer, right? And go, okay, like, what can we look at 10 to 12 months ago?
That's
incredible.
Let me ask you this, Tyler, because I've heard, you know, I've been in the sync world a little bit and not so much actively getting placements, but I've done some courses and stuff and I've sort of spoken to a lot of people. And Chris obviously is a great wealth of knowledge in that world too. How do you feel about when targeting ads, doing like market research? So if we're sort of saying that, like, you know, maybe pop charts are 12 months ahead of what ads are going to do, you know, would that mean that maybe it's not the best idea to use market research of like old BMW commercials and like kind of the commercials of this era in terms of like building sound alikes, building your, you know, your mood board, so to speak? Where do you sort of stand on the market research idea?
Love that. It's a great question. And yeah, I did a lot of that. That's great. I think that the way that I've quote unquote won a lot is, I just kind of use my gut as far as what I think is going to go to the masses. So it's like, you can go look at the charts and speaking specifically pop, but I'll talk about advertising market research in a second. But if you're looking at pop charts, you can listen to a track in your gut and you can go, you know, I don't see Target aligning with that. You know, I don't see whatever. It's like, you're not going to get some, you know, rap thing that has all the cuss. Like, it's just not something. Yes, that'll happen, but it's like, the swearing and the whatever, all that's right. Like, it's just going to turn ads off. They don't want to attach to that, right? Mm-hmm. I think what you start seeing is, instead of specifically narrowing in on like the current BMW commercial or the current Budweiser stuff, yes, I do get briefs that say these are the ones that have won with this particular agency in the past. So just take note of these, but we need something current. So what I would do is I would take a temperature of the market. And I also, my favorite, I'm a huge cryptocurrency nut and I love cryptocurrency because it's not only finance, but it's also social and social media and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm a nerd about that. I love watching trends. So what I would do also, I'm getting chills just thinking about it because it's so fun. What that particular All About That Bass track spoke to me, and this was right at the beginning of the feminist kind of movement and the empowerment of women. And so what I saw and I saw coming was in the social settings, I went to my singer and I was like, hey, we need to write an empowering song for women. And that was exactly what happened. It started going into the feminine movement and women were starting to feel more empowered. And all of a sudden now, for like 2.5 years, you were seeing all these companies empowering women. You know, Target had like 5 or 6 huge campaigns about empowering women. And we wrote with the concept of, what would this brand want to attach themselves to socially that's also happening in the charts? Mm-hmm. So you're like not only watching what musically is happening, but you're also looking at the world. So I get briefs now that say a lot about LGBTQ, you know, like, we'd love to have this particular. I got one today for a TV show where it was these two women are going to kiss in this romantic moment. We need this dreamlike track and we would love it if it was, you know, a certain type of artist, you know? So it's like, I know I'm always going to get that wrong, but LGBTQ, all the different things, but that's a very popular and very like social thing that's happening right now. And you start to see that reflected in not only sync, but you see it reflected in music. So I think to me, it's about zooming out. It's not about like, well, what did BMW use for the last campaign? It's like, zoom out and take a temperature of what the social aspect is happening and try to, it's like crypto. It's like trying to guess what the next big thing's going to be. It's like,
right.
Take the temperature, look at what's coming. And also, it's really important to hear music and pop music that you would listen to that's current. And like I said, to go back to the beginning, it's like, would it work for Target? Would it work for this? Like, because there has to be an element of safety and vanilla in ad music, but there has to be like a lemon swirl, you know, you just have, you have the safety, but you got the lemon swirl. And it's like, what's the lemon swirl look like? And most of the time pop music is like a big lemon swirl. And all you're doing is you're making a little lemon swirl. So it's like, how do you take the temperature socially? And then what is the vibe of what would work now in pop music? And I, as soon as I heard that All About That Bass, I was like, oh my God, I hear this on a Target commercial all the time. And I think she landed, her next two singles were immediately commercials. And that just propelled that whole female movement, you know?
Right.
And I'll take this as an example. I landed two commercials, one with Google and one with Budweiser, during COVID. And you know what that was I had another song. It didn't land anything, but I have a feeling it was going to, but it was called There For You. And I had these other two land because it was, you know, it was, frontline workers. It was very emotional. It was people clapping, you know, in Canada, everybody would ring the bells and stuff. Yeah. It was all getting chills, but it's like, I had these classical pieces that I would write to picture. And I got the temperature of the land of there is such a somber element of what's happening right now. And if you can capture that ahead of time and see it coming, then you're going to have a better chance. And my mentor who taught me a lot about this was very adamant about that. He's like, and he was always right. He said, Tyler, and he would do it with movies too. There was one point where you remember, you know how Batman went from like a cartoon to like the darkest thing you see, you know, it's like, he was like, Tyler, I think everything's going to go darker. It's going to get like more aggressive. And he said that in the ad world, cause he had a Sears commercial he landed that was like, oh, it's the good life, you know, like this happy world. And he's like, that was when all the whistles like,
yeah, you know, Jason Mraz.
Yes, exactly.
Ukulele whistle.
And I have landed a bunch of those. It's funny, but he was like, you got to stop doing those, man, because they're not, they're going to go away. And sure enough, they did. And then it became female empowerment. And then it became like, you know, this aggressive kind of energy. And it's literally just about taking the temperature of the world, basically.
I remember when every brief that came across my desk for 2 or 3 years was female empowerment.
Yes.
I was like, here we go. That's so smart. Like, yeah, taking a temperature of what's going on socially, as well as maybe like, you know, it's like kind of like when you hear of an artist that's like, oh, you know, I want to get a cut with like Carrie Underwood, and they write Carrie Underwood songs that like were cut like 10 years ago. It's like, no, you got to go where she's going. She doesn't want like what she did last time. But I think you can always like find that common denominator of a brand from a feeling aspect, right? Where they may have used Led Zeppelin, you know, been a long time since I rock and roll. And then they may have used Rihanna on another, but it's like, find that common denominator of like, what's the feeling of like coolness or, you know, married with a social cause, and see if you can kind of hop on that, right?
Absolutely. So, and it's like, you wouldn't want to listen, like Taylor Swift's not going to sing Tim McGraw. You know, it's that song's like, I hear it now and I'm like, wow, that's not even close to where she is, you know?
Well, and it's funny because she has genre hopped so much and done so many different things, but there is a Taylorism in everything that she's done that like, absolutely, it's still there. Like, brands maintain that like foot in, like it's that one foot in as they explore, you know, other things around them. So, 1,000%. Okay. So I'm curious now, cause I'm thinking of this All About That Bass, About That Bass. Now I can't get that out of my head. So like, what would you say is the difference between like the production when you go to create a track, like if you were making an artist track for her as opposed to what you did for the ads, like what are the differences in structure and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's very different. And I think people, that's the biggest mistake people make is they, as you like to always say, Chris, and I love this, is reverse engineer things. And my real big wins have always come from, okay, put it up to a picture and does it work first? And then two, I've done enough now where I've talked to enough ad agency people that I, those are the people that come to you and tell that they want your track to be a little bit more red. You know, it's like they don't have that musical. And a lot of people would take that personally and be like, how dare you not know music? But I don't take it personally. And because, and going back to your point earlier about, you always love working with people that put you like, here's what I want. Like, I literally just did a two song campaign for a finance company that finances, does stuff in CrowdStreet. I should know, because I've heard the overdub talk in my head. Like, I was dreaming of the overdub because it was just always playing. And the person, the agency I work with, the creative director, is a great guy, and I've done a bunch of stuff with him. And this particular one, we were chasing something that he really was hearing that I was trying to find. And sometimes it just works. Like, we did one campaign where he's like, yep, these are great. And then sometimes it's like, no, something's there. So he's trying to communicate to me. He's trying to communicate to me like stuff that he doesn't understand. So I'll play a chord and I'll be like, do you want it to be kind of sad? Do you want it to be happy? Do you like this movement? Because, you know, as more you do music, the more you realize certain movements create certain emotions. It's like, that's a good exercise. It's like, happy, what do you do? Right. You know, sad, what do you do? Thoughtful, you know, it's a good exercise to do that. And so when you're in those situations with those people, you realize that they're not musically inclined, and they either cover up for it with their ego by stepping back and being like, I know music and your track sucks. Or they're like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, I don't know how to explain it. And this particular guy who had worked with other people in the past said, I'm so sorry, Tyler. I'm just giving you all the information that I'm capable of, and I'm doing my best. And I had to stop him. And I said, man, any information that you give me is valuable. I don't take any offense to anything. Like, if you don't like a track, you don't like a track. Like, I'm not attached to it. I'm trying to capture your vision. So when you reverse engineer from people that really aren't in the music industry, and sometimes they were in the music industry, they didn't quite make it, and they've got a chip on their shoulder. And it's like, it's just about making their ego feel safe and making them feel like, hey, you're cool. If you don't like it, let's go in a different direction. So if you reverse engineer from, I love reverse engineering from this place of, I have this vision in my head of three men in suits that make $500,000 a year in a white office with a television that are going like, okay, we got to figure this thing out for Target. And what I would do is reverse engineer to a place where I'd even do it in a place, like even go as far as to say, they don't even have a sound system. It's literally on a laptop speaker. And they're like, okay, I got this track from this guy named whatever the band is, you know, and it's my band, whatever. And then it's like, we checked them out. They look pretty cool. Let's listen to it. And on the laptop speaker in this multi-million-dollar office, they hit play. And I think to myself, first of all, how do I get their subconscious to feel safe? How do I make sure that they play it twice? And how do I make sure it doesn't overwhelm them? So if you go from those perspectives, when you look at how you're building a track, all about that bass is great, but it's more about repeat listens. It's more about, there's interesting things to find in it. So what I would do is I would, even again, putting myself in these rule boxes, there's such clear rules. It's like, you can't have an intro that's too long because they'll get bored. Lyrically, it can't go too deep because it's going to be cheesy, but it has to go deep enough where they're interested. Mm-hmm. There can't be eight hooks. I'd stick to like two or three. But what you do is you take the two or three hooks and then you start stacking them on each other. So that's a little trick, because I'd introduce a hook. Then I'd play the same hook. So their subconscious is like, oh, I know that hook, but then I'd introduce a new one. So it's about it really is about making the listener excited about it, but not overwhelmed, and doing little subconscious hacks to make them feel connected to it. And there's ways to do that. And to me, it was always as much organic element as you can put into it, because we respond to organic stuff. And then also, if there's a singer, if there's any type of vocal, anything like that, you have to make it so that it feels, and not in their face. And the way you do that a lot is with vocalise, where you're just doing, you know, it's just not words, but just melodies with singers. Mm-hmm. And, or like almost every track that has landed for me, I could talk about this verbatim. It's like, to me, when somebody is not a musician and they're not listening from a musician's perspective and judging the chord changes or the lyrics or whatever, it's very tribal. And I believe that there really are four elements in advertising. I call them the four C's. But one of the things is like carnal, like drumming and stuff like that. Like, how many Nike commercials are LeBron James like shooting a basketball? You know, that's one of the C's I call carnal. But it's like, but also the thing that wins all the time is gang vocals. When you have gang vocals in your track, if you can, and I can stuff them in R&B, I can stuff them in pop, I can stuff them in singer-songwriter, I can stuff them everywhere. Because what it's doing is it's telling the listener that whatever is happening is safe and it's cool. And
it's a party.
The whole tribe is on board.
Yeah.
If you can stuff gang vocals in, and I mean stuff, but if you can put them in there somewhere and there, you can always find spaces for that. That to me is also a way. So I reverse engineer it, literally thinking about what those three people in that office are going to want to hit play again, feel safe subconsciously, and not get overwhelmed. And that's how you build your tracks.
Wow. Oh my God, I love that. That didn't go where I was expecting it to go, which is awesome. Cause I was like, oh my gosh, like make them feel safe. Like that's such a unique way to put that. So it sounds like as you've been going through kind of, as we've been talking, like multiple genres, you've referenced, I've done rock, I've done R&B, like I'm stuffing that as singer-songwriter. Like, is there any one genre that is best suited for ads, or is it really a multi-genre space?
To me, the best genre that's suited for ads is whatever genre you're the best at. So,
put that in your pipe and smoke it.
I can show you examples of all these different genres and the rules are exactly the same. And all you're doing is you're just putting those rules and you're putting them in a box. So whatever it is that is your superpower, like we talked about earlier, whatever combination of superpowers that you have, you can literally reverse engineer from those people in that office to whatever your superpower is, and you can literally take off. And you just go. You go with the rules, you go with what you're good at, you combine, and then you just color in the boxes. And as long as you're always checking in and from a perspective of what is this going to be received like? How is this going to be received? And if you go by the three rules, like I said, of making them feel safe, making it interesting, but not overwhelming them, then as long as you're checking in on that, genre has nothing to do with it. And literally, as long as you're not stepping into a genre that you're not comfortable in, but genre has nothing to do with it. And I do also think that taking the temperature of advertising to preface by saying genre has nothing to do with it, you could make a song that sounds like death metal with these rules, but your chances of getting an ad are probably not great. So I would say that, yes, you could make a track that's in these rules in all these different genres, but taking a temperature of what genres are working. And again, that goes back to what is happening in pop music now and what genres do you feel what brands are going to resonate with what's on the radio now. And if that genre fits you, or if you feel like, yeah, Target, we get behind that, Walmart, we get behind that, McDonald's, we get behind that. And if you can see that genre and then also see, okay, cool, well, I can see this coming later and I'm going to put these two rules, that mix is going to be the thing that's probably going to win the most. So you just have to take, again, the temperature of what genres are working. And pop music is right there. You have it right at your fingertips. And you also know that there are certain genres that, not slaying anybody, but, you know, I'm not a big death metal fan, and I don't think that McDonald's wants to do a death metal commercial. And I'm not saying that death metal's bad. There's a huge following for that, but I just don't think it resonates with certain brands. I could be wrong.
Well,
but
maybe 24 months from now.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, depending on the way the world works, death metal might be where we're headed.
Would you say that overall, though, like, I mean, speaking to that, like, they're really, it sounds like love songs, are kind of a no-go, which is actually kind of, you would think being that upbeat is kind of a common denominator. I was surprised to learn that love songs they're often not looking for that, right? Because it's not, I guess it's not as universal, right? It's like, it can be like, I love life, I love my friends, I love it, but not like a like, romantic love, rather. So death metal's a no-no, love songs are a no-no. Would you say that positive and upbeat and up-tempo is a common denominator among successful ad music?
Yeah, my thoughts on that are, anything can be successful for sure. Like my friend saying, "Our land is your land," for a Budweiser commercial that landed on the Super Bowl. So it's like, you never know, right? It's the way that I like to look at it is, like I said, these umbrellas that I always write in, is it either has to fall under the umbrella of it being cool, as in like slick, you know,
mm-hmm.
Carnal, as in the tribal stuff we talked about, connection. So like that's your togetherness, your friends, you know, like you're like, "I got you, you're fine," all that kind of stuff. And then catchy
there
to me
is
the current stuff. So it's those things that I really think that whatever genre can fit under that with what's pop at the time is going to work. However, you're absolutely correct. The thing that has always worked for me is the concept of how do you get your song to sync with the picture so that the person that's listening wants to move to go buy the product?
Mm.
And the way that that functions for me always is you have to have a beat that's driving. If you're doing like a pop thing, like, again, like I said, like I did a piano solo thing for a Google ad and it was just piano. There's an emotional side. That's the connection thing. Connection also can have, singer-songwriter can have four on the floor, but I'm not discounting, like if you're a beautifully trained classical pianist, absolutely you can do this. So I don't want to separate that out, but you're absolutely right. I think if you're going to win the most, you're going to have some kind of driving beat. And the subconscious concept of that is, get the person to go to the store. Get the
right
person.
I just
to go
think
to the
of the energy that's moving. It's like, what is happening when you're listening to the music? Like if it's upbeat and it has like a good beat to it, it's going to make you, like, your body want to move. And I would think that that would be what a brand would want, so that you can move to get up, to make it over to the store, to pull out your wallet. And, you know, it's that energy, right? It's like, if it's drag ass energy, like that, like who wants that? You know, while that might be appropriate for a specific scene in like a movie or a TV show, if it's meant to paint that picture, advertising is it's sales, right? And sales is usually coupled with upbeat, good feeling, you know, energy, emotion, vibe, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I'm just thinking about some titles that have been most successful for me. Like one of the songs that was the most successful is that I've been talking about. It's called "Here I Come." Another song that I've had is called "Moving On." You know, it's like do your own thing. It's like, it's, these are the titles that you have for the pop thing. And then it's funny, the most successful singer-songwriter I had landed in a few things, like a Starbucks commercial, stuff like that, of like a family, like Christmas time, you know, having coffee and stuff. That song's called "Home." And that's not movement, that's safety. So there's a lot of subconscious concepts too about like, you can either make them feel safe and together and stuff like that, or "I got you." Another one I have is like, "We're all in this together," or like, "With you tonight." You know, it's like those safety things. And then coupled with, if you're doing a pop song, they want you to move. They want you to buy the product. That's the whole point.
Oh, such a good point.
What's interesting too, what you're kind of talking about, Tyler, and you know, I think one of the biggest mistakes I made when I was first trying to dive into sync was to try and do things I was not very good at, but seemed like the thing to do. And, you know, as you talk about like monitoring temperature, like mid-pandemic, every commercial that was out there was like, "We're here for you." And it was like sombery, like rise from the ashes sort of vibe. And I think like ultimately I kind of pivoted a bit, but I think I would have found more success earlier if I, you know, like I'm better at sort of singer-songwriter, like home style songs. Like I can knock out like all day long, but I was trying to sort of get like the green light goes snappity pop stuff that, you know, all the people that we were writing with weren't very good at. So the idea that you're kind of mentioning, you know, for artists that are trying to break in, maybe start with the thing you're really good at. And, you know, in your position where you're sort of covering the gambit, people that are coming in, you know, staying in your lane is really valuable. Like if you can knock out a home song, like it's your life dependent on, like that's amazing. And then that doesn't mean you can't, that doesn't exclude stuff later to go into these other worlds. But I think trying to spread yourself so thin and be like, "Well, I'll just cover all this stuff." It's like, well, if you can't do a Meghan Trainor kind of track, figure out what you can do. And maybe that doesn't mean you can get every brief that's going to come your way, but the ones that do come your way, you can nail. And then you can sort of, you know, grow as you want. Cause I think that a lot of artists trying to get into sync try to be everything to everyone instantly. And that can sometimes, you know, lead to no results because they kind of do everything mediocre. And that can be really, you know, really counterproductive to what their goals are.
That's a great point. Absolutely. And I would say, I would further that point by saying that think about who you're competing with. You're competing with other people that are amazing at what they do.
Right.
So it's like, why don't, I remember this when I was living in New York City and I was I just finished my jazz degree and I was living in New York City studying there, and I was playing saxophone, and I was also like writing songs on the side and getting kind of flirty with that, like, oh, I kind of like this. And I realized that all the things that I wanted to do in the music industry, I couldn't do in New York City, because if I wanted to be a saxophone player, I had to like pick my lane. Not only did I have to pick my lane, it's like I couldn't be an overall saxophone player. I had to be like, well, what era are you from? Are you from the 50s? Are you from the 80s? Are you John Coltrane? And I'm like, I don't want to be pigeonholed like that. Like, I want to have all this freedom. And so then moving to Nashville, it's like, okay, well, use your superpowers and go. And I really do believe in the concept. And so many people talk about this in business and stuff too. It's like, get really great at one thing, because you're competing with other people that are really great at it too. And if you dabble and use, I'm an energy guy. So it's like, where do you put your energy? And if 20% of your energy is here, 20 is there, 20 there, it's like, you're not going to get to the top of the mountain because somebody's putting 100% of theirs there. Mm. So it's a matter of, just remember that who you're competing with are people that are at the top of their game. They want that $100,000 too, you know? And it's like, if you're not at the top of your game or working towards the top of your game, then, you know, like you said, you're just going to keep running up to roadblocks because you just don't have enough energy to give to the thing to get you to the top of your game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's great. I think it's so helpful for people that feel very overwhelmed, because I think sync is really overwhelming, because it's one, it's foreign. So people are like learning about it, maybe on this podcast, if this was even an option. And then they listen and go, and I have to learn a new like genre like that I don't even dabble in. I think there can be a lot of stack that can maybe just, you know, sort of, Chris, you always say, how do you eat an elephant? And it's sort of one bite at a time. I think that can just be, you know, reassuring to people that maybe get a little overwhelmed with the process of sync in general.
Yeah. So if somebody, let's say somebody's listening and they want to break into the ads world, like what's the like one piece of advice you would give somebody wanting to explore this avenue to increase their revenue as a musician?
I mean, I would start studying ads. And I think the way that you do that is, there's a great website called iSpot.tv. And you can go there and you can study what's going on, how they're working. And I would even make a list of what, I didn't do this myself, I did in my head kind of, a list of different genres that you're starting to see, a list of things that are happening. And the coolest thing about iSpot.tv is that they tell you how many times that particular ad has been played. And also they tell you the name of the musician and if they have it, the band, the artist. And then what I would do is I'd start Googling those artists. I'd go to their Spotify and I'd start listening to what the song sounds like away from the ad. And I would start learning the rules and I would start looking at, well, why do they put the chorus first? That's weird. And they put the chorus first because they want it to be, it's the most interesting thing. And the person, again, if you reverse engineer, they want to hear the chorus first. They don't want to hear a 12-bar intro. So you start to see these patterns and you start to see these things from these songs and start thinking about the different genres that you're connecting to. And then then start going at that umbrella that I'm talking about. And one of the most valuable things that I did that I pushed away for so long, because I was like, I'm not going to do this because I didn't land that ad. What I would do is I would go download MP4s of big ads and I would write my own ad to it. And that to me is a really valuable tool, because what it does is it helps you with pacing. It helps you learn pacing. It helps you learn film cuts. It's like, if this pacing works for this particular thing, it's going to work for something else, because it's almost always going to be repeated. Like, what do they say? History doesn't repeat itself, but it
like rhymes.
It rhymes. Yeah. It's like, it's not, thank you. It's, I knew you would know, Patrick. It's really very consistent. And, you know, that's because what's happening is there's huge ad agencies that handle so many different brands, but you're having the same person that's working with Target, that's working with, you know, McDonald's. So it's like they're getting their personal touch. So if you're starting to get their pacing and you're seeing the pacing of how your stuff is, literally, like you said, Chris, too, like it's upbeat or whatever. It's like, if you get your pacing to sync with that particular picture, then no doubt it's going to sync with a picture in the future.
Yeah. That's so great. That's such great homework, you know, to prepare yourself for. So thank you for that. So, oh my gosh. Well, Tyler, thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with us today and share some of this. I'm really excited because we are actually having a live masterclass happening next week called How to Build a Brand New Revenue Stream for Your Music in the Highly Profitable World of Advertising, which Tyler is going to be joining us in leading. And I believe you're going to speak to those four C's, right?
Those four C's. Yeah. And I definitely am going to kind of genre bust, I guess I would call it, and show people, you know, that the rules really do cross all the genres. So, yeah, I'm excited. I would definitely want to dive into some stems specifically. I'm going to talk about like the different, you know, how to write different hooks, how the form of advertising is built, as well as I'll show you some ads that I've landed and you'll start to see consistency. Like, for example, that Here I Come song, like I think I have like 8 or 9 different ads and I'll show you how they're used, be it Tommy Hilfiger, McDonald's, at Angie's List. Like, it's just so interesting how they are used. Like Angie's List, the ending of the thing goes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's all Angie's List used. It's like, it was like this home repair thing. And then all of a sudden, da-da-da-da-da-da. And then the McDonald's one is like almost the whole commercial. It's just somebody walking through with a coffee and this works, you know. So it's interesting to see the use cases and then look at the song itself and realize the structure is it's the rules are so specific and it's just a no-brainer when you sit down and if you put yourself in the box. So what I'm going to do is demystify, so to speak, what might be overwhelming about writing music for advertising to a place where, yes, there's no specific rules. Anybody can land stuff. But I'm going to give you my concept is I want to make sure that your track gets to the head of the line. And I think that if you follow some of the rules that we're going to go over, you're going to have a success. And literally, the coolest thing about it is you don't need to be overwhelmed because if you're good at what you do, you already have the hardest part. The yeah. easiest thing. That. All you got to do is just take your mindset, your concept, and just shift it to these rules and put yourself right in that box. It's so easy to do that. And yeah, I want to show you those rules so that you can take what you've already built and the skills you've already built and get another side hustle. And I mean, it's nice to go to the mailbox every quarter and have a song that took 3 hours that pay every quarter.
Oh, hey, yo. I love that. It feels like a real, like it, as you're saying that, it's like you're going to decode this, you know, and it's like, it's almost like math at that point. It's like, you got the talent. Great. Let's plug it into this kind of this framework here and like get you off to the races, you know? So, so excited that you're going to be joining us next week. That's going down on the 16th, November 16th at 5 PM PT, by the way. And we are going to drop a link for that in this podcast and this YouTube description as well.
Man, oh man. So shall we wrap up there then? This has been, you know, we always say like I'm the boots on the ground guy on the team because I'm in the artist world. So it's always a good litmus test when like Tyler, you were talking, I was getting so excited.
Like, oh, good.
Really?
Good.
You're going to talk about all that stuff? I mean, it's just, Chris, we speak about this idea of like, hey, if you're really good at the thing you do, then like, let us help you monetize it. And this is sort of another faction of that idea. So I can't wait for the 16th. Hope everyone checks it out. Like we say, links in the description and we'll leave it there and we'll see all you guys in like a week from now.
All right. Thanks
guys. Thanks so much, guys.
Peace.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Produce Like a Boss podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. We had a ton of fun chatting with Tyler. And I know usually we take the show out with a song from Chris, but today we're actually going to call an audible and we're going to use an original track from Tyler himself. So I hope you enjoy it and we'll talk to you next week.
When lightning strikes, do you sit around just waiting for the thunder, the sound it makes? When clouds roll in to cover up the sunshine, do you wait for the life they bring? Take a breath, your soul will soar. Trust there's hope outside your door. Valleys come and time stands still, but flowers still grow on hills. Do you see the waves crash up against the shoreline, carrying away the sand? you feel the burn of a cold wind in winter. Smile at the snow and embrace. Take a breath, your soul will soar. Trust there's hope outside your door. Valleys come and time stands still, but flowers still grow on hills. When you've been knocking on the door one too many times, pick yourself up off the floor. Just means there's more to find. Know that there is darkness before the light. Take a picture frame and imagine all the faces full of laughter you helped create. Take a breath, your soul will soar. Trust there's hope outside your door. Valleys come and time stands still, but flowers still grow on hills. Flowers still grow on hills. Flowers still grow on hills.